The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In.
You have always been a voice of reason through all of this.
Appreciate your time, what you're doing for America.
I give you advice, and it doesn't work at all.
You are definitely not inept by any means.
I like to hear women say that about me.
Whatever advice you're going to send my way, I am 100% taking it.
I can't tell you what to do. I will not tell you what to do.
Okay. Well, thanks.
That wasn't the answer I wanted.
Are you kidding me?
Great stuff, Dr. Ray. I'm glad I called.
I've scheduled my day around listening to your radio show.
You don't have to laugh so hard.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Thank you for joining me for whatever part of your day you have. I will be grateful for 9 seconds. Get enough of you joining for 9 seconds, can have a bit of an audience. This is The Doctor Is In. This is Look Back Friday. There's calls up there on the board already there from people who have called before. And Andrew Kruchek, my producer man and call editor, his capable hands, his legerity. That's a good word. I just learned it. I get this thing that comes to my email called Word Genius. You got to get it. They send you a whole bunch of words probably every day. They are getting to be a pain in the bucket. But I am broadening vocabulary. I'm becoming more magniloquent by the moment. I didn't know terpsichorean was having to do with dancing. This is stuff that you never, ever use. And if you do use it, you sound pompous. You sound like you're engaging in gasconade. Okay. Before I get to that, there's a park near me, about an hour and a half away, called Cedar Point. Now, Cedar Point has more roller coasters, I think, than any park in the world. It's known for its roller coasters. When I was younger, that was the big, big gig, is to go to Cedar Point. All those fast-moving, intense rides, which now if I go and I'm going to bring a 5-year-old grandchild, I'm going to just be very happy to get on those little cars. Those little cars that you drive around at 3 miles an hour on a track that has a middle rail so that you can't get off the track, and they go. And I try to look cool. I throw my hands up in the air like you do on a roller coaster, but I just do that on. Well, okay, I don't throw both hands up in the air. I just throw one. I always keep one hand on the steering wheel. And I noticed that when I used to ride the big roller coasters, they always had somebody taking a picture of you, a snapshot picture of you. And it was very clear. I mean, you could see you screaming easily, the look of terror on your face. Wasn't that great to have in an 8x10 glossy for your mom? So it got me wondering, how come those cameras can snap a crystal clear picture of your face? But when I watch these crime-solving shows and the cameras and all the places where there's cameras, and there's tens and thousands of cameras now all over our society, they can't get a clear shot. I don't know, just wondering. Maybe that'll get the technology they use on roller coasters. Parents will tell me that their teen really doesn't want to go with them anymore. In the old days, when you had a lot less means of entertainment, if mom and dad went somewhere, yeah, you wanted to go. You thought, okay, well, I'll go. It's a knock me out of the routine around here when there's nothing much to do but chores. Maybe watch 3 channels of a TV, which is what we had, and we were grateful children. Nowadays, they have so many options. Computer. Almost all of them have a smartphone, to their detriment. They have many options. So why do I want to go with mom and dad? That's boring. And we allow the teens to dictate that. I've noticed this. You want to go with me? No. Okay. Sometimes we're just running errands. I still suggest that every so often you make them go with your running errands. And you know why? Because it's time alone with a particular kid. And you never know what kind of good conversations are going to erupt. That's the first thing. But perhaps more so is that you may be going someplace that is good for them. You're visiting grandma. Or you're visiting an elderly aunt. Or you're going to go do something at the parish. And they don't want to go. And you're thinking, well, I don't want to force them if their heart's not in it. You know, I kind of want them to want to do it. I think that you don't let the kids decide whether they're going to do it. You decide. And if you think that is something good to expose them to, make them come. I was 14 years old, smack in the middle of my 8th, 9th grade year, prototypically wanting to do 9 other things at any given second than to go with my mother, who goes and visits her dad's sister, Nana. That's Italian for aunt. I thought Nana was about 175 years old, somewhere thereabouts. She was in her 80s. So mom would go, and she'd make me go. She'd take me. Like, what's that name of that bear? And those bears in that cartoon. I'm not going to enjoy it. So I'd probably sit there at the kitchen table as Nana offered us biscotti, some good Italian thing. At least that kind of salvaged the visit. I didn't say much. Mom and Nana talked about different things. And she talked about her childhood, or she talked about life as it was for her as a 80-some-year-old widow living alone whose husband had passed away some years earlier. She wasn't a whiner or a complainer by any stretch. She just talked about good things. I listened because I was sitting there at the table. Mom wouldn't let me go turn the TV on. So I sat there. Yeah, okay, yeah, I'm bored. But little by little, she said things that I was interested in, because I would ask her. She'd talk about being a little girl in Italy and what that was like. And to my 9th grade sensitivities and sensibilities, my life was very, very different than anything she experienced. I mean, she didn't even have indoor plumbing, didn't have electricity. It's like, how do you live like that? What do you do? Where's your bathroom, Nana? We made several visits. And I developed a great respect for her, because she wasn't this elderly person that needed to be ignored, put on a shelf. She's a religious lady. You could tell that. Entered the house, crucifix was there. And I developed an appreciation for the elderly. I learned what they have to offer in terms of experience and insight and wisdom and history. They lived history. She lived World War I. She talked about what it was like when the Italian village boys had to get conscripted to go fight. They didn't even know what they were fighting for. They were just given a gun and told to go fight. Can you imagine that? Those of you with 17-year-old sons, government comes and says, all right, we want your son. We're going to have him go fight. Who? We're just going to have him fight. The Allies. Who's the Allies? What's the Allies? Didn't know if he's going to come back. She talked about that. It was fascinating stuff. Against my will, I developed a respect, an attachment to older people. And to this day, maybe it's because I'm getting old myself, but even when I was younger, I didn't view him as somebody who, yeah, you're old now. I don't know whatever life you had when you were younger, but you're old now. You're invisible. I don't know if that would have happened without my mom making me go visit Nana at age 14. There's a lot of lessons about life you could give your kids. Don't let them decide to entertain themselves at home with all their options for entertainment and all their goodies and all the things they want to do. You don't have to hog tie them kicking and screaming to go with you. But I think it's good, wise parenting to say, these are experiences I want you to have. And sometimes you got to have them against your will to realize that in the long run, they're going to be real good for you. And now, well, I just hope my nieces and nephews come and visit me. That's all. It's my only request. Dr. Ray.
Hello, Steve Ray here. Hard to believe it's already been 20 years of leading Catholic pilgrimages. So we're going to celebrate with a Danube River cruise. We've chartered our own ship. We'll share meals and enjoy good Catholic fellowship together. We hope you can join us next June through Budapest, Vienna, Salzburg, Prague, and a whole lot more. But sign up quick. It's already more than half full.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the pilgrimage link.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Hello, I'm Marian Kowarski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
Pro-Life Across America.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Thank you for joining me, Dr. Ray Grandy. Program Doctor is in. Look back Friday. So let's go to our first look back question. Sandra from Virginia. She's experiencing something pretty common. She thinks, she believes, she feels guilty about not being able to give her mom the care that she'd like. So you have a mom that, yes. Well, she's getting to the point where you can't handle her at home?
She is now in a nursing home.
Oh, okay, so you've made that decision.
Actually, the doctors kind of made it for me. She moved up here about 5 years ago, and I've been taking care of her. And she just got worse and worse about falling, and she has the dementia got worse and worse. She's not like severely dementia, but maybe 50% on the travel line. And the last time she fell and she was in the physical rehab, they told me that she needed to stay in a nursing home where she could be 24/7. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to put her in a nursing home. So I took her back home, and from June the 1st until about the last week in August, she fell four times. The last time she fell, that I know about, that she fell, the last time she fell, she ended up in the hospital with fractures, and that doctor said she has to go into a nursing home where she can be taken care of 24/7. So she went in for physical rehab at this very nice nursing home, and she was expecting that when she finished her course of physical therapy, she would be able to go home. But no, she can't. So she said, I want to get out of here, I want to get out of here, I want to get out of here. So that's upsetting. And then, you know, so then I start questioning, well, could I really bring her back home? So that's where I am.
Well, what has changed? If, in fact, a lot of the professionals are saying she's at a point where she's dangerous to herself and she needs 24/7 monitoring because you can't keep an eye on her constantly. What's changed? Why now? Is it because she said, I want out of here?
It's because she's so unhappy. You know, she's so unhappy. And it's a beautiful place, and the staff is wonderful. It's not, there's nothing wrong with where she is. And I, it's about 45 minutes from my home. I go to visit her three times a week, and I do her laundry. But
What would happen if you brought her to your house?
Okay. Number one, my house is not set up for an elderly person. It has a lot of stairs. And number two, I do have a bedroom downstairs, but it's extremely small. And she has a very large dog that I'm taking care of now that she is devoted to. It's her baby.
And how would you supervise her? How would you supervise her 24/7?
I couldn't supervise her 24/7 because I have to do my other responsibilities. So I would have to leave her and pay somebody to stay with her while I was gone.
Do you have the money to do that?
Not anymore, since I've paid for everything since she moved up here 5 years ago, and I furnished her house, all her utilities, her food, everything.
So what you are saying is, on a practical level, a very, very practical, logistical level, as well as finances, as well as her safety, it's not an option for you to have her at home, correct?
It is not an option without extensive renovations and, you know.
And you know as well as I do that, sadly, she will continue to cognitively deteriorate, correct?
Definitely.
Sure. So you're running up against something that pretty much, and we ran up against this with my mother-in-law, pretty much there is enough with itness to say, hey, I want to be at home. I don't want to be here. But at the same time, there isn't enough with itness to say, I can't care for myself even with somebody keeping an eye on me. It's not possible. They don't have enough insight to say that. Now, if it's any comfort to you, my guess would be that sometime in the relatively near future, your mom will give up this idea that she wants to go home, other than a recurrent kind of complaint, but there will be minimal understanding of where she is and maybe minimal understanding of even who you are. That hasn't happened yet, has it?
No, she knows who I am. She's always waiting for me when I come through the door. When she says, I want to go home, what do I do?
I would say something like, well, for right now, Mom, this is the best place for you because I can't have you at home because of falls and because of a lot of things that we can't keep an eye on. Now, she's not going to accept that, but at least you'll feel better in offering an explanation. But my guess would be that, Sandra, you will have to offer that explanation every single time you go in there, because until she gets to the point where she's further down the road, sadly, in the dementia, she won't give up that idea of, why can't I go home? Because part of her cognitive slippage is that she doesn't have enough insight to know why she can't go home.
No, she thinks she's perfectly fine.
Exactly.
I can walk. She can't walk anymore.
Right, exactly.
I can walk. I can do this. I can
right,
do that.
Right, exactly.
So, well, okay, so basically do
you have
I
no reason to feel guilty. If you feel guilty, you're creating it in your head because there's no reality that you should feel guilty. Interesting how we do that to ourselves, isn't it? In essence, Sandra is saying, I don't want it to be this way. I don't want to feel guilty about placing. Now, we could argue whether she placed her mom there. I think circumstances placed her mom there. But I don't want to feel guilty about my mom's circumstances. And furthermore, there may be an undercurrent of blame toward me by my mom because of where she is. Sandra went through a litany of all the reasons why logistically it was not possible for her to care for her mom. She couldn't supervise her. In essence, what she was saying is there was a very high risk that mom would hurt herself. Now, unless one is willing to say, well, I'll take that risk, and if and when it happens, well, mom's going to be real badly hurt. Most people are not willing to do that. So the option, the alternative, is not a good one in their eyes. The good one would be that her mom would say, you know, honey, you've done a lot, and now I need to be supervised 24/7. This is a place that I wouldn't choose to be in my former competence, but now I realize this is where I have to be. Very few say that in my experience. Far more likely to resist it. Because as I said, part of their onset of dementia is a lack of understanding of their status. They don't get it. I'm perfectly capable. They don't realize that 2 days ago they wandered away from the house. That's gone. That memory's gone. They don't realize that they put a pan inside the microwave and almost set things on fire. They don't realize that that's gone. So what Sandra is saying is, I don't want to feel guilty about this reality. That's what it is. I don't want to feel guilty. Well, the only way not to feel guilty is to convince yourself, realistically, that there is no reason to feel guilty. I don't care. I still feel guilty. Well, if one is determined to feel guilty, no matter what the logic and the evidence and the reason is, then you're going to feel guilty. And until mom gets to the point where she doesn't recognize anymore why she is where she is, she just is. She just exists on a day-to-day basis with very, very little short-term memory left. Then Sandra's going to endure this level of insight that her mother has. It is a bit, and this is not uncommon in dementia, because there is a period of time, depending upon the progress or the regress of the dementia, where the person recognizes, I'm not being allowed to do what I think I should be able to do, or I can't do what I used to do, or I'm scared at my loss of memory, or I know that I can't carry on a conversation and understand like I used to, and that really, really makes me anxious. So that level of insight is often there, and maybe that's where Sandra's mother is. But Sandra's saying, I don't want her to think that. That's what she's saying. And the reality is, she's going to think that. So if you're going to feel guilty about something, make sure that you're responsible for it and that you're not doing what you should be doing so that you can legitimately feel guilty. But much of the time we feel guilty because we're really saying, I wish it weren't this way. We'll be right back.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Suffering in the world, personal suffering. One of the biggest things that keeps people from really giving themselves over to the Lord or joining an organized religion. Suffering doesn't seem to make sense. Why do children suffer? Why are there wars? Why is there persecution? Why are some people poor, others rich? Why is there such an imbalance? And on and on and on. A loving God wouldn't do that. Well, God doesn't do that. First of all, we did it to ourselves because in the beginning, right, we chose incorrectly. And then sin came into the world. It was not supposed to be like this, but God gives us free will. He does not want to force himself on us because otherwise we would be puppets. But how many of us can look back and forget what came out of a particular hard time? You don't learn really good, strong lessons when everything is going great.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
What does the Catholic Catechism teach concerning the natural human curiosity and desire to know the future? Paragraph 2115 counsels us that a sound Christian attitude consists in putting oneself confidently in the hands of Providence for whatever concerns the future and giving up all unhealthy curiosity about it. What does the Catechism condemn as unhealthy curiosity? All forms of divination, deifying objects as persons, are to be rejected, as are consulting horoscopes, astrology, palm readings, interpretations of omens and lots, clairvoyance and mediums. All these venues conceal a desire for power over time, history, and other human beings, powers that belong to God alone. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You ever notice that this facial recognition software that they're coming up with now can pick a person out of a crowd of thousands? But yet, I noticed that the vending machine at my car wash won't recognize George Washington if the bill has got a bent corner. Yeah. Anyway, I just think about those things. This is Look Back Friday on The Doctor Is In. Let's go to, let's see where we're headed. Looking at that, and that. Allie from Colorado is worried about being a failure, but not to other people, to God.
I'm just kind of struggling, and I've been really turning to God, which is nice, but emotionally I feel like long story short, I left pumpkin seeds in the oven and I almost burnt down my very first home. And
well, that was dumb, but it's not a failure. Allie, that's dumb, but it's not a failure.
You can't make the
illogical leap from I did something dumb, so therefore I am dumb.
It's the guilt, though, and I think it originates
guilt of what?
From, like,
guilt of what?
Oh, just messing up.
Oh, well, welcome to the world.
Yeah, it's tough.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying that if you don't show yourself competent in the things that you decide are worthy of competence, like cooking brownies or being good at sports,
yeah,
or whatever you decide, God's going to say, well, Allie, you know, I used to love you a lot, but you're really not all that competent. So when you get a little more confident, let me know, and I'll love you more. Now, you actually think that?
I know it's not true, but it is sometimes how I feel like I don't want to disappoint God, and it's always been a thing that I've always had.
Well, there's a big difference between wanting to live well for God and wanting to, quote-unquote, live well. The difference is we define what we think would be competence. Okay, let's just say that EWTN comes to me, Avi comes to me and says, you know, Ray, we're taking you off the air. I don't think you're that good. So thanks. It's been a nice run. Okay. Now, I may be disappointed, but I'm not going to see myself as a failure. If anything, I'm going to say there are folks who think I'm not very good at this. And in fact, maybe I'm not. But so what?
Yeah.
That means nothing in God's eyes.
Yeah, that's true.
What you're doing is you're measuring yourself by these self-established standards that have nothing to do with morality. They have to do with, well, I didn't do that very well, or, gee, I didn't do that very well. Oh, gosh, I look stupid there. Didn't I look kind of stupid there? Why did I say that? That was really a dumb thing to say. You could live your life doing that.
Yeah.
Until you realize how ridiculous that is, Allie, until you say to yourself, why am I doing this? This is really, now, you want to be dumb? Okay, I'll tell you how you're dumb. You're dumb for doing that. There you go. You want to feel dumb about something? Feel dumb about feeling dumb. Certainly. God wants your love and obedience, and that's what matters. And if you say,
yeah, but I'm not very obedient either. I just can't believe I do this.
I don't think he's going to go, let's see. I've been keeping a score here, Allie, and you only got three more slip-ups, and then you're going to get fried. It's a good thing that Christ died for us so that we can get to heaven, not because I can be competent in a whole bunch of things, including my obedience.
That's true. Thank you. That's very helpful. I really appreciate it. I've never done this, so thank you.
There's a standard illogical leap in people's thinking. It's self-personalizing. Let's say that you mishandled a situation. You sneezed while you were trying to do a radio show. It's easy for some to say, because I failed at that, I am a failure. That's an illogical leap. You failed at that particular thing, at that particular time, in that particular context. Yeah, but if you fail at it a lot, then you are a failure. Well, who decides how many failings constitute you being a failure? We take our standards and we place them upon God. We can't understand this. How could he still love me given the way I am, given the way I act? Morally or otherwise, how could he still love me? Because that's who he is. It's his nature. He doesn't function like us. We have a hard time loving somebody if they fail us repeatedly. Three strikes, you're out. Eight strikes, you're out. God doesn't work that way. She said something interesting. She said, I think God would be disappointed in me. Well, that kind of language is anthropomorphic. Boy, I like using those words. I don't know what it means, but it sounds really fancy. I've heard Colin Donovan say that. I've heard Jimmy Akin say it. I've heard a lot of these smart apologists say it. So I just decided I wanted to use it. It means using our terms, our language, our perspective, and placing it upon God. We're giving God human principles. He would be disappointed. God doesn't get disappointed. He doesn't have human emotions. We can't understand that because that's the only coin of the realm that we talk in. We have to talk like that because we don't know any other way to talk. Nevertheless, recognizing we're inaccurate when we talk that way. God's not going to say, Ray, I'm major disappointed in you. No, I'm sure that to the degree I can understand how God looks at things, I would think that he would prefer, again, that's a human word, he would prefer me to act a certain way. And by his grace, hopefully I can. But what's happening is when Allie says, I didn't do this right, I didn't do that right. Gosh, I was so embarrassing at that gathering. I can't believe I said that. On one hand, if it's a moral issue, it's a virtue issue, you look at it and you recognize, all right, I want to do better at this. I'm getting toward the end of my life, just from the number perspective. And I still am working on a lot of the same things I worked on 50 years ago. I still can't hit the right field line like I should be able to. But if I were to dwell on that, I would despair. I would say, well, what's the use? What's the use? I can't get to the point where I want to get. And it's a good thing that God doesn't measure us that way. I think if he's going to measure us by some way, it's going to be by effort. Like Mother Teresa says, he asks us to be faithful, not successful.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread, meaning me. This is the bread which comes down from heaven that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, oh yeah, I know that passage? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
What is idolatry? Idolatry is the worship of false gods. Paragraph 2112 in the Catholic Catechism tells us that Scripture constantly recalls the rejection of idols such as silver and gold fashioned by men's hands. Such empty idols make those who worship them as empty and dead and lifeless as the idols they create. The one true God, on the other hand, is the living God who gives life and who intervenes in history. Paragraph 2113 warns that man commits idolatry whenever he reveres or worships a creature in place of the Creator, whether it be power, pleasure, ancestors, the state, or money. Jesus Christ warned us that we could not serve both God and mammon. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
One of the societal byproducts of our rapid turning from God and his ways, from Christ and his ways, is that the generations, there's been huge religious rifts between the generations. And this is something that, by and large, and I've talked about this many times before, is really kind of unprecedented in Christian history. The forces that shape the way the younger people think are very powerful and very seductive, and they're very intrusive. And those kinds of forces were never part of living, at that level anyway, ever before in human history. So as a result, it's not at all uncommon. As a matter of fact, it's the norm for parents who tried to raise their children in the faith to watch their children leave the faith, reject the faith, dislike the faith, hate the faith. And the byproduct of the byproduct is that it's hard enough for the older generation to watch the younger generation leave the faith, but then they watch the younger generation's lack of religion be the guidepost with how they raise the grandchildren. That certainly distresses Ruth.
My question is about my daughter. She married a young man who was not Catholic, but he did come over and he wanted to receive the sacraments. And that was about 17 years ago. And after that, a while, she went into the service for 8 years, and he was home with us. And he started just stopping going to church, and he stopped receiving, and he started telling me that he didn't believe in the Blessed Mother. So, you know, I thought he was going through some kind of a, I don't know, separation from his home or from church and for what he was believing in, maybe because my daughter was in the service and she was like in harm's way, or I don't know. After that, she came home and she went to work, and we had a great relationship. He said, I will never go to church again, but he never told me why. And then she had her first child, and she was baptized. After that, when I spoke to them, because the girls, well, they were growing, and I expected her being a Catholic, profound Catholic, and all my children, that she would start taking them to church and have them baptized. She had the first one baptized, and after that, she never went to church again. And the girls.
Did you talk to her about this, Ruth? Did you talk to her about this?
I did. And she said that her husband was the head of the house. He had the right to decide where his daughters were going to be taught and what. And he didn't believe in the Blessed Virgin, and she was going to respect him, and I had to respect him.
Let's summarize it. He just doesn't want to have anything to do with the Catholic faith anymore, and she went along.
Yes. Okay. And I thought that was not her part to do that, because she was born and raised a Catholic.
Well, it's her part to do. Ruth, wait. It's her part to do anything she wants. It's not that it's necessarily good, and it's not that it's not risky to her soul. But right. She can do whatever she wants. Now, have you stopped seeing them, or have they said, don't come over here?
She said she came over a couple of months ago after 4 years, and she said to me, you have to stop.
Wait. After 4 years, you hadn't seen her for 4 years?
Yes.
Wow.
I spoke to her a lot, but I had not seen her.
Ooh.
They live in California. I live in Clarksville.
Well, even at that,
they don't come over.
Okay, they just don't want to visit you. And he doesn't talk to you at all.
Well, he used to, and he stopped somehow because I would say the little girls.
They don't like the way you be Catholic.
That's right. And then my worry is, I'm 70 already, and I thought that my duty was to speak about Jesus and speak about Mary and speak about the church.
Not when they throw it back in your face. Not when they tell you, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Well, what is Jesus going to say to me when I look at his face?
Now, I knew you were going to say this. So here's what you're saying. You're saying, I got to keep approaching the subject, because if I don't, the Lord's going to hold me accountable.
Yes.
Okay. Are you familiar with what our Lord said when he sent out the disciples two by two? And he said, talk about the faith, heal the sick, cast out demons.
Yes.
Go to a house that accepts you and stay there. But if they don't want to hear what you have to say, what did he tell them to do?
Just take the dirt off your feet.
Yeah. That was a rabbinic way of saying, that's it. That's it. You don't want to hear it? I'm done. You're not.
But as a mother, we always have a responsibility for their child.
Well, you had that responsibility. You raised her for 20 years. You did it.
Don't I have a responsibility for my grandchildren a little bit?
No, not if they don't let you.
Oh.
No. If it's in essence what they've done is they said, look, we don't want to hear any more about this Catholic stuff. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, we really don't like the way you're Catholic. I mean, we could probably tolerate you if you were just kind of a marginal, lukewarm sort of Catholic that kind of followed the culture's ways and thought the way the culture thinks. But you don't, Mom. So therefore, first of all, you are not allowed to talk Catholic. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to say anything. We will not tolerate, because we're so tolerant, you having any beliefs of your own. That's what they're saying. So when they've made it so clear, your best move is just to have the best relationship you can have with them and avoid the Catholic stuff. Avoid it. Not so long ago, there was a Old Testament scripture reading at Mass. Said basically, if you don't turn an evil person from his ways, you'll be held accountable. Now, that scares a lot of people because they're thinking, oh boy, how do I do that? If my nephew is living with his girlfriend and he's long since abandoned any kind of morally guided faith, am I to tell him, okay, what you're doing is wrong? And he'll look at me like, says you. I don't buy any of that stuff. So that verse, if it's taken out of context and stripped away from the whole rest of Scripture, can scare you. But there seems to be certainly plenty of scriptural guidance that says you do what you can, but you recognize, for example, when our Lord said, I've come to divide family members. He knew what he was saying. He was saying, look, some of you are going to accept me and who I am, and other people in the same family are not. And that's going to cause rifts. It's a common theme that I hear, not only in my office, but just informal calls from people, which is, where's my responsibility? How much do I have to keep telling them about this faith thing, and all the aspects of it, even when it threatens to destroy our relationship? Well, at least I've done my part. Well, we are called to be prudent, good judgment. Many of the people that I know in my life, that I hang around with, I play sports with, I do things with, they're either Catholic on their terms, or they're not any religion whatsoever. None, zero, zip, nada. They think totally like the culture thinks. Do I go around and try to correct all of them? Do I go around constantly looking to shape their morals within some kind of Christian context? I can't. I would have no friends left. I'd have a lot of strained relationships. Yeah, I do my very best to live as I can and what I believe, but I can't be responsible for how they live, and I don't think our Lord expects us to be responsible for how somebody else lives. And that's not just guesswork on my part. I think the Lord thinks this way. No, I think there's plenty of scripture evidence and church teaching that would indicate our level of responsibility ends at some point. And when you've raised somebody that's now an adult and has made it clear, I don't want to hear it, then you're actually doing damage. In some respects, you're making them more antagonistic toward the faith because you keep coming at them with it. And they keep thinking, shut up. Back off. Sadly, I've seen an awful lot of relationships just fracture because somebody just doesn't know when to shut their religious mouth. You win them over by being a warm, caring, loving person. You don't win them over by battering them with the morals that they're not living. So, I think Sandra struggles with guilt, which says, I have an obligation before Christ to keep coming at him with this, because if I don't, that means I am ashamed of Christ. I'm not living for him. Doesn't mean that at all. And I would hope that she would go to a priest that could settle her mind down and tell her that, because virtually every priest I know of would tell her that. I'm Dr. Ray.
I knew it was you. Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
There are legitimate differences of opinion in any religion. There are differences of opinion in Catholicism. But in Catholicism, you expect that people will take the teaching of its supreme authority seriously. To go diametrically opposed to those teachings is to not be a Catholic. Someone in the name of Catholicism is sponsoring the destruction of human life, lives of unborn children. And he got the name Catholic on the door. The highest authority in Catholicism and the encyclical Humanae Vitae, Evangelium Vitae, is absolutely clear that no Catholic can support abortion and that Catholics are responsible to take serious action against legalized abortion.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
I spent my first year of college in engineering at Case Institute of Technology, and my son, who is an engineer, definitely had a much more engineering-inclined brain than I did. And I think what scared me out of engineering is I looked at the one of the tests to get a master's, and it was the disassembled parts of a high-powered rifle have been placed on your desk. You will also find an instruction manual printed in Swahili. In 10 minutes, a hungry Bengal tiger will be admitted to the room. Take whatever action you feel is appropriate. Be prepared to justify your decision. So I thought, you know, that's a pretty high obstacle to pass for engineering, don't you think? So then when I went to psychology, this was the exam. Based upon your knowledge of their works, evaluate the emotional stability, degree of adjustment, and repressed frustrations of each of the following: Alexander of Aphrodisias, Ramses II, Hammurabi, Freud, Hitler, and Idi Amin. Support your evaluation with quotations from each man's work, making appropriate references. It is not necessary to translate. Don't know how I got through psychology. I just got a little bit of time left here. Let me just read this from C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain. Some say that death ought not to be final, that there ought to be a second chance. And in fact, no, this is me talking, not C.S., the Latter-day Saints believe that. Latter-day Saints believe that after death, everybody will be given a chance to choose for or against God, if I understand their teaching correctly. Lewis goes on, I believe that if a million chances were likely to do good, they would be given. But a master knows, when boys and parents do not, that it is really useless to send a boy in for a certain examination again. Finality must come sometime. And it does not require a very robust faith to believe that omniscience knows when. Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. You know, some people die at 19. Had they lived to 80, would they have come to the faith? Or some people live to 80 and abandon the faith. So had they died when they were nine, would they be within the faith? And Lewis is wrestling with that. He's saying that an omniscient mind knows when seems to be the best time for someone to have the final decision made. And that does seem to make sense. If a million chances were to do good, they would be given. That's C.S. Lewis. Pretty smart guy. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In on this Look Back Friday. Thank Andrew Krucek, my producer man. Walk with God. Don't look back.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.